I could say there's nothing like a good introduction, and that was nothing like a good introduction. But, you know, but I won't. Could I have that little gadget down there, please? Thank you. Just to try and take control of it. Thank you. First of all, can I just say that from a very personal perspective, the honour is mine to be here with you. It's a fantastic turnout. You've supported CEDA, and I stand here in front of you as my principal claim as a really proud West Australian. West Australian who loves this state. Of course, a proud Australian as well, but with a very parochial attention for what's best for Western Australia. And I can only bring to this my own experiences, and I trust you'll forgive the shortcomings of that. But I will try and share with you, and certainly in questions share with you, why my thinking is as it is. So let me just roll you through a presentation quite quickly. I will also be speaking about something which I think is critical for regional development, which is Indigenous employment. You know, I've heard enough argument that Indigenous employment has in fact got a stealth prospect of assimilation, which is a word I've never heard of apart from when the ideologist gave it to me. It's not about assimilation at all. It's about the fact that I grew up and my parents grew up and my grandparents and great-grandparents grew up with Aboriginal people who were more than happy to be stockmen, to be drovers, to do their jobs. In my own generation, I can remember aircraft mechanics and motorbike mechanics and the best stockmen I've ever worked with. And mechanics who had a feel for an engine, they could just feel their way around it and pick what was wrong with it. And know full well that these people then left us on weekends and they went to the law, and they led their communities in their culture, and passed that on to friends of mine now, who are unfortunately only with us in spirit, because the welfare attitudes of our nation has unfortunately killed them with drugs and alcohol and as much money as they ever needed to buy it. So where I'm swinging you to is that regional development is terribly important. It's terribly important from the perspective of not only the Australian economy, and in particular here the West Australian economy, but from the perspective that when things are a little crook in Tullaroog, when things are tough, and there's no admitting that it's tough now, and we need to dig deep into our characters to be able to make the decisions which will carry the state forward and be one which we're proud of in 3 or 4 years, but in 30 or 40 years as well, when we look back on what we've all achieved. Those parties which will get left behind most and where we as a state will be judged won't be by our skyscrapers and our towns and cities, our local GNP. It'll be how did we treat, when times got tough, the outskirts of the state, the regions of the state, how did we treat the most underprivileged, in particular the Indigenous or the original Australian? And, of course, if we treated them poorly, then we are to be judged even more poorly. So let me just launch with that little introduction. There is a negative thought cycle out there, and, you know, I know the statistics can swing either way here, and I'm not a statistician, but what I do know, I constantly get told by my leadership that I can judge a people and judge a situation even though I'm bloody lousy at operations. And, you know, I think that's probably correct. I've got great operators who do that. But in judging people and situations, I've grown up in the Pilbara, and I can see that you have a cycle there which has emerged, which we never saw until the mining industry started to lock in, of the people of the Pilbara of the Northwest looking at the country as somewhere temporary before we scuttle back to the safety of our only real city. Now, that wasn't what I grew up with. I grew up with a Western Australia who was really proud of its regions, who there's almost a romance. Why else would you put up with the conditions? There's almost a romance about living in the bush. And you lived there because you were proud of it. You lived there because it offered you a real lifestyle, and you lived in those country towns and those emerging cities because they could give you that culture and they could give you that kinship, which is often much harder to find in very big cities. So what we have now is an virtuous thinking cycle where people don't want to live in places like, let's pick Port Hedland or, you know, anywhere else, because there aren't the facilities. And if you leave it to the marketplace, you won't ever get the facilities. And of course, people don't want to put in the facilities, the cafes, the towns, the cinemas. There's not even a cinema in Port Hedland. People don't want to move there or live there or raise their kids there because the facilities aren't there. So you've got the lack of facilities leading the lack of people and the lack of people leading the lack of facilities. Leave it to the marketplace. It won't be fixed. Like Greenspan got it so terribly wrong in his absolute faith in the marketplace. We saw a complete and utter meltdown because the marketplace, in fact, has deficiencies which are centred around two things, short-term thinking and greed. Now, they're very powerful, very proper emotions in the right context, but out of context, they can be extremely damaging. Witness the credit crisis. We have the same thinking, just as relevant to us on a minor scale, but even more important, with this virtuous thinking cycle of not having leadership which will plough the facilities in from whence forth the people will come. And I can only say to you, there's hundreds of family members who I've spoken to who wouldn't think about shifting to Leonora because there are no facilities there when we did Murrin Murrin, and the same context with Port Hedland as we've done Fortescue. And so when I speak of mining companies getting it wrong, I'm being very personal in that criticism towards myself. The thinking of fly in, fly out does destroy the social fabric of the communities in which they're in. And while I know the stats say, well, hang on, fly in, fly out workers, you know, adapt to it, they get used to it, that's all true. But is it best? And are they just doing it for the money? And if the money wasn't there, would they continue to adapt to it if they had a choice? And what would happen if the money wasn't there to justify that huge separation from their family? You know, because Fortescue has a fairly hands-on CEO, and you know, a CEO sits in an egalitarian environment, which is open plan. People can walk up to my desk whenever they like. It's not in the statistics, but I see the family breakdown because I hear about it, because it walks up to my desk and it tells me about it. And I see the tragedy of fly in, fly out, and I know that people are enormously adaptive. I know that people live great existences in extreme environments because they're so adaptive, but is it the best for them and their family? That is the thinking which is outdated. A fly in, fly out workforce is an accounting-driven mentality because there's simply no facilities where they're flying into to attract a family. And, of course, family is the core. Family is the fabric of society. So let me just march right along. This negative thought cycle, as I've mentioned, I just want to underline it. A thinking cycle with negative consequences, it stops regional development as people will not move where there are not facilities, and the facilities will not move where there are not people. So leadership, government, corporate sector, those who want to make a good quid but step outside of their comfort zone by providing facilities in regional areas where there is growth. And you can look to the Pilbara before this, and I'll just comment in a moment on the economy. It takes bravery and it takes leading with your chin, and all of us in Western Australia have done that in the past. In fact, we are the great state we are because we do that more than most and most states. Now, to say to you, yes, we are dependent in large scale on China. And if you speak to Roger Anelli, who runs Vale, the world's biggest iron ore export company, he'll say there are regions of the world, in his kind of excitable Brazilian Spanish personality, where they want nothing, nothing, nothing in terms of his iron ore exports. And I can say that's correct. And if you're sailing ships from the other side of the world and having to put up with that shipping cost, you'd be about right. But the Pilbara happens to be tucked up under the nose of Asia. And because Asia has billions of people in it, and those people are looking at you and I right now and saying, why haven't I got what they've got? And they know it's not lack of the sweat of their brow or the strength of their arm. It's the fact that they don't have yet the opportunity, and they want that opportunity, and there are kids as smart as ours, and they should get that opportunity. And that overwhelming driving force, which is rent by communication, by the BlackBerry, by CNN, is going to continue. And no ships from the Pilbara that I know of are getting turned back. No ships from the Pilbara that I know of, in I think one of the worst crises we've seen, are getting turned back. They're getting treated with open arms because they are the most competitive form of iron ores. And when things do turn lopsided, the Pilbara becomes even more important to Asia and not less. So, and I say that by saying mining in the Pilbara need not be treated as it has been when I got it wrong, as a great big open pit. It's in fact a permanent centre of activity. It could be an industrial activity like Silicon Valley, or it could be, much more importantly and durable, it could be the iron ore industry, both hematite and magnetite. And when the billions of tonnes of hematite direct ship iron ore are mined in the Pilbara, you will still have the railway lines and you will still have the ports and you'll still have a fabulous workforce. And more importantly, you will have trillions of tonnes, which will last centuries, of very competitive magnetite. That's called banded iron formation. It stretches for 800 kilometres. BHP, Rio, FMG, we just stopped counting. And that is stretching right across the Pilbara. It's poorly understood, but it's where around a third to a half of the world gets all its iron for its steel source from. Yet we barely touch it here because we don't have to, because we've got billions of tonnes, which will eventually run out, of hematite. So I'm saying, think not of the Pilbara like we all have, as a big, somewhat temporary open pit. Think of the Pilbara as this permanent growth engine, which is going to be with our grandchildren. And we should be thinking about our grandchildren today, because it makes good economic sense for the day after tomorrow, and tomorrow and today. It's what we need. We need regional development, and we need to discourage fly-in, fly-out, if for no other reason than the deleterious impact, which I've seen on a very personal scale, on families over my 15 to 20 years of doing this. But, of course, I've given you the absolute economic arguments as to why it should happen now from an economic and not a non-personal perspective. So what are you doing, Forrest? You're putting your money where your mouth is? Well, in fact, we are. We aren't investing at the same rate which we were prior to the financial crisis, but we're still investing heavily. And to show the kind of communities we are creating, we're creating an ethos which is about a residential workforce. And just explaining to friends in my table, you don't get employees wanting to invest in a house which isn't built yet, but get them into that house and make it a house which they're happy to live in, then they want to buy it off you. And so we have to, once again, lead with our chin. We have to put those houses there, and governments are the leaders, and other leaders must step up to the plate, which what we in the private sector have failed on, and that's the facilities. So just to prove that point, there's areas A to E there. These are the areas which Fortescue is currently building in now to create a permanent workforce. We're investing in the community. I think one of the largest privately funded, if not the largest privately funded sculpture, is being installed as we speak in South Hedland to commemorate the victims of Cyclone George and the huge endeavour of the volunteers around that time. So there is, and we're building on a community atmosphere which does exist and is strong there. Key design features of houses is, you know, I'm sure we've seen the bomb shelters which have typified the original cyclone-proof houses of the Pilbara, which us station folk, when we went to the mining towns from our big wide homesteads built out of timber with iron ropes holding down the roof, which actually did, you know, lasted quite nicely for 120 years, we couldn't believe these kind of bomb shelters which we walked into. And they were all, of course, built around being cyclone-proof. Well, as technology's moved on and the knowledge of how people have lived previously for the last 130 years has dawned on the architects, you've now got these large open-plan houses, plenty of space, plenty of veranda area, and being welcoming. Now, this is where I'd like to talk to you about another very critical factor of the West Australian social fabric, and that's Indigenous unemployment. And this isn't to be preachy, this isn't to try and tell anyone what we already know. This is just to share with you what myself and friends are doing and what seemingly corporate Australia in a very historical context has stepped up and got behind. So, you know, the issue surrounding Aboriginal people right now all over Western Australia is lack of training. And it's actually, to borrow Obama's term, it's lack of training that they can believe in. There's been so much training which hasn't led to a job that now Aboriginal people in many contexts don't want to be trained any further because it's just a vicious cycle of training, no job, get different training, still don't get a job. To crack that, you need to guarantee the job. You need to have the Aboriginals with change, which, again, Obama, they can believe in. And they'll only believe it if there's a guarantee of a job, if they complete the industry-specific training. And, you know, a big argument which I had with a major publisher the other day, you know, talking about his role in ensuring a recession in Australia, just simply because his publications were making, just delivering us a diet of pessimism. You know, I will step off this podium, I'm sure, speak to my friends in the media. I might deliver 10 messages which will all be positive and one which may not be to add balance. What we'll read tomorrow will be the one to add balance. Of course, out of context, it'll appear as a very negative story. That's happening all over Australia. It's happening all over the world. We're, in fact, having a press which is giving us the recession we didn't want to have by talking us into it. So nowhere will the knife of that pessimism be felt more keenly and deeply but in the Indigenous community in Western Australia. This is going to compound as a problem, team. We've got 26,000 Aboriginal school kids leaving school in the next 2 years, joining the ranks of around 85 to 100,000 unemployed Aboriginal people, jacking it up by some 25% in 2 years. And, of course, it's increasing exponentially after that. School kids' problem? Fault? I think not. Not their fault. Definitely their problem. A problem which is our opportunity if we step up to the plate and fix it. And these are conversations I'm sharing with you, which I've had from, you know, Rupert Murdoch to most Australian corporate leaders, to say this is our opportunity. You've looked at it as a problem, but how fantastic would it be, Chief of ANZ, to be able to employ a regional workforce anywhere you wanted in the country, trained in the low and medium skills you so desperately need and can't get people, just ask the fruit pickers, when you want them, where you want them, with the skills you want, before you employ them. And they step up and say, well, I never looked at employing Aboriginal people like that. I thought it was going to hit my back pocket. And you say, no. This has got no profit and loss impact. This has got no balance sheet impact. This has got leadership impact. What I'm asking you to do is to strongly improve the culture of your organisation. As the head of Pepsi Cola found when he employed that fantastic Australian who said, listen, my company doesn't really want to work for Pepsi. It's, you know, we sell, you know, highly sugared drinks and give, you know, kids health problems, if we're going to be blunt. What can I do about it to make sure that my workforce population really believe in Pepsi? And they chewed through the problems and they discovered that, hey, we're destroying about 4 litres of good fresh water for every litre of Pepsi we make. That's part of the perception problem my workforce has. What about we create 5 litres of fresh water or 6 or 7 litres of fresh water for each litre we sell in communities where they're desperate for water around the world? It turned the psychology of Pepsi's workforce. Where I can walk into any major bank or organisation or even the smallest companies, which is why I finished the speech last week in Kirribilli House saying, from Rupert Murdoch up, not down, for anyone who employs one Aboriginal person, you are a champion. that comes from the fact that not only does the company make a commitment to employ those people they have to employ anyway, but are trained and facilitated and put into their workforce where, when and with the skills they need, you offer a one-for-one mentor system to have, if you like, a mate in the workplace. And that is proving to be incredibly powerful. The CEO shoots that letter out firstly to divisional heads saying, tell me the skills you need in the low to medium skilled areas. Tell me the workers you need around Australia and when you want them, because I've got a plan. So the line managers send that up, and then he formulates how many Indigenous people he could employ if those three criteria are met. And of course, that's why it's a covenant. It's a powerful promise, but it's underpinned by those three criteria. And then a letter goes out from the CEO or from the chairman to all the staff at that bank or that major organisation. And it says, I can't do this on my own. You know, I'm not daddy chief executive looking at uncle government to fix the Indigenous problem here. We're going to do our personal bit as every Australian. And I'd like you to join me to volunteer to mentor an Aboriginal person for everyone we commit, we covenant to employ, provided our three conditions are met, where, when and with the skills we need. The CEOs who have done this have wanted to step out of the road because their workforce have killed them in the rush, and the culture of their organisations has grown dramatically as a result. That everyone, like the Pepsi example, has been able to do something for themselves, and 95% of Australians, if you can believe this, have never met an Aboriginal person. So the prospect of being able to workmate an Aboriginal person into your organisation who has the skills already becomes very appealing if anyone has a heart to help another person, which is, of course, the most dignified thing any of us could ask for. So let's look at the opportunity. Employers of Australia are stepping up, and we can resolve it. Trained by trainers, we give the specs as employers of Australia, government departments, whoever you are. Even if you employ two people, make the third an Indigenous person. They'll be trained to the skills you need, when you need them, where you need them. That's the government's part of this covenant. And, of course, Australians guarantee those jobs. That leads, of course, strictly into the Australian employment concept. I'm just going to flick through these pages because you can't obviously read it on the screen. I got yelled at by my secretary because this all arrived in PDF from Kirribilli, the Prime Minister's residence in Sydney, and, of course, we couldn't break it down into a page-friendly document for you. But just to show you the work which got ploughed into this and its reality, the fact that it is being picked up by Australian employers, big and small. And there's 50 documents out on tables fanned if you're interested in pursuing it further, which actually describe this. So let me just walk you through it. How it works, it's basically a pyramidic structure. You've got the Aboriginal people. There's 87,000, as you know, soon to turn into 110,000, 115,000 unemployed Aboriginal people who can work, who are talented to work. And, of course, you've got 75 to 80% of this original Australian population within the mainstream economy, meaning they're 5 minutes from a job. So they step up first and they say, we want that work, and provided we're guaranteed of the work, will we train and leave our welfare system. The government steps up and says, righto, Indigenous person, what job do you want? Because I've got a list of jobs from casino croupiers to mining operators to industrialists to manufacturers waiting to employ you if you're prepared to be trained to the skills. They identify those jobs and the government provides that training. It's a massive opportunity, of course. And we're aiming to put 50,000 Indigenous people into work. Before we started, we had commitments for 6,000, over 10%. So you can see, even despite things being crook and Tullarook, this is happening. And, of course, the Australian employers, in our case, West Australian employers, are the direct beneficiary of two things: a workforce skilled to the skills we need where and when we want them, and a strongly improving culture of giving the opportunity to every one of your employers the opportunity to reach out and touch and improve the life of another human being, in this case, the original Australians. So key concepts and goals. Sorry about that, guys. Let me just roll you through it. Information for employers, information for Indigenous Australians, information for mentors. The mentors I've spoken to, we'll need 50,000 mentors to step up across Australia to act as good mates. Good mates at work is what is required here. Then, of course, those 26,000, which should be occupying our minds greatly, because they will be a huge drain on the economy or a huge injection into the economy, and we actually need that injection. We are short of people in this country, and we are home-growing these people who need the training. Let's get out there and employ them. That's the organisational structure, which I won't take you through, but interestingly for me, when I've started any organisation, I've chosen the very best people and unfortunately draw them as divisional heads or chief executives from other areas, and you try and get them to all work together and it makes herding cats into a bag look terrifically easy. But after a few serious think tanks and alignment sessions and headbutting, they actually come together as one very creative, very inspired team, and that's what we have now operating in Western Australia is the Australian Employment Covenant with offices in Sydney. And when we went out and I spoke just as bluntly as I have you to the corporate leaders of Australia, even from friends of mine who are particularly competitive to what I've done in the past, hey, we might compete in our careers, but the Indigenous employment regional development issue is a challenge for all of us. We get it wrong, we leave a terrible legacy for our children. Are children that we're only effectively borrowing the future from. So from the Prime Minister, the heads of the ANZ, AMP, you know, National Australia Bank, Newscrest, News Corp, you know, they all took time out to attend this launch. And before they did, these are the various companies who stepped up to the plate and said, right, we will commit for 10 people, 50 people, 1,000 people. People like Leighton Holdings, Construction, Crown, casinos. I mean, they're pretty different. Then you've got Hannon Removals, Removalists, Fortescue Metals, Santos, Linfox. Again, you're stretching across Australian industry. We're not saying this is a mining industry issue. It's not. It's an Australian. It's an each and every one of us. If you run a government department or you run anything, you ever employ a person, it's our challenge. It's our opportunity. And finally, so we're breaking that cycle. I wanted to speak to you about breaking the cycle of Aboriginal unemployment and breaking the cycle of regional welfare. And I say that because that's what fly-in, fly-out is. It's a massive welfare problem where we butter up those people who fly in and fly out, contribution little or nothing to the local community, with a sophisticated form of welfare, of perks, of high salaries and the like. But we, in fact, separate them from their families. We separate them from the communities and very often from their marriages. So welfare dependency and high unemployment is particularly strong in these areas where, hey, our Indigenous people also reside. So you've got this double-edged sword there. And where I've spoken before, a regional city in the Pilbara, you've got the city of Geraldton, you've got other cities. A regional city in the Pilbara makes absolute common sense. We just have to lead the facilities. The people will follow. Thank you very much.